Football Weekly Extra.
Rising bravely above the week's cacophony to bring you a cold night in Southend as Kevin shares in Chelsea's Cup rebirth. Manchester United and their midweek Wigan win. How much, though, will Rooney's hamstring hamper their progress? Italy, are Jose's Inter heading for a pickle in Bergamo? Spain, what is the scandal that now spells Real trouble for Madrid's president? Your posts and the Premier League weekend. Like Gibril Cissé at the barbers, are we set for new colours up top? All that in your special Football Weekly Extra. Welcome on board, everybody. And in particular, I refer today to Chief Football Correspondent, Kevin McCarra.
Hi, James.
Barry Glendenning. Barry, you're a deputy something, yes?
I think so.
Yeah, okay,
I'm nobody's sure anymore.
All right, if you work at The Guardian and you know what Barry's position is, do let us know. Matt Scott, hello to you.
Hello.
And what's your position?
I write the world infamous Digger column.
All right. You write the stories that make the whole world sing, in a very real sense. Coming up, we've got Sid with big news from the Liga. And also, I believe we can speak to Fernando Duarte, much missed Brazilian correspondent, who has got a few words to say to us about the big story of the week, which has been Kaká. Now, as we record this on a Thursday morning-ish, it looks like Man City may have or may have not withdrawn their offer, which maybe Kaká didn't want to reply in a positive way to anyway. We'll see. But let's dial up Fernando now and hear what he has to say on the matter as a close personal chum of top evangelical attacking midfielder Ricky Kaká. Fernando, welcome back to the pod.
Hi there, James. It's been a long time, isn't it? I'm still kind of like with my tongue burnt after saying, you know, that Liverpool didn't stand a chance of winning the Premiership, something like that.
Yes.
How happy I am to be wrong.
Indeed so. Well, the game's not over yet. The fat lady, etc., she hasn't, you know, done her singing business yet. We want to talk to you, though, about Kaká as a man in the know. You've just been penning an article for top Brazilian publication, O Globo. And what have you been saying about this whole deal?
Well, you know, it looks like a poker game for me, James. It seems that there's going to be a lot of bluffing around, a lot of like raising the stakes. I mean, let's see if you call, etc. Because I don't really think Kaká is, you know, doing somersaults about moving to Manchester now, moving to City. Yeah, I'm sure he's going to be following the team's progress and seeing that even with Robinho, they still managed not to, you know, haven't managed to actually go to the right side of the table. So I think what he's actually doing is now that the people see that Milan is not totally rejecting bids, that somebody else could enter the game, somebody else could sit on the table, perhaps Chelsea, perhaps Real Madrid. So I think there's going to be a lot of twists and turns around. I don't think it's only going to be a matter of money for him to jump around. But now, that's my perception. Everything can change in football.
But your view of Kaká is that, first of all, if there's anyone in football who might turn down a deal just because it's more money, you think that might be Ricky Kaká, who has, slightly different values to your average footballer. Secondly, does he want away from Milan? Because he keeps making comments like, I want to grow old at the Rossoneri, and he's certainly the right club to do that.
Listen, Italian football in Brazil is still massive. It's still one of the most followed leagues, and a lot of people have like emotional attachments to teams, even though they've never been to the cities. For example, I support Naples, and I've never been to Naples before. Just because we watched those teams, etc. So it's there's an emotional link. Also, he won things there. He's an idol there. He succeeded in one of the most traditional sides in the world, and he likes it. I mean, it's not that he's unsettled. However, he doesn't seem too happy. I mean, I've been hearing things. I haven't spoken directly to him about this, but I've been hearing things that he's not very happy with the board there. The way they've been signing people, the way they haven't been listening to the young guard in a certain way. That is still the monopoly of the older guys like Ambrosini and Maldini. That might be kind of like pissing him off a bit in this situation. That, for example, that they're not making the right signs. They're bringing old players. That entire house cleaning, that spring cleaning that Milan needed, and Kaká thinks that they needed, is not being done. And this might be unsettling him a bit. Having said that, I don't think he's not going to just slam the door shut because of that.
Listen, that's fantastic stuff, Fernando. Thank you very much for that. We look forward to seeing you back in here soon.
Anytime, man, anytime. Hello to all the podcasters and to all the bloggers as well. Take care.
You're a sweet fellow.
Cheers.
Well, interesting stuff there. The view very much in Italy seems to be on this, that he won't in a million years go to Man City. But the very fact that Milan have been a bit wishy-washy about saying no, the headline on today's Gazetta is no but dot dot dot.
Exactly. Yeah,
is that it will open the door for, say, a Real Madrid down the line?
No, I don't think so. I think Man City have put it beyond reach of as far as other clubs are concerned, beyond reach of sanity. They set a price for them that I think Real Madrid probably couldn't even find the money, for example. But what I wanted to say was, speaking to people in Italy, they were saying that it became about 108 million, including Gattuso and Dida. Gattuso has got a dud knee and has had an operation with Richard Stedman. But
Dida is Dida.
Yeah, and Dida's Dida. He's 35 and they don't want him. But anyway, leaving that to one side. But that was what Chelsea said on day one at the first meeting. So as I understand it, Milan think, well, maybe there's more money in this. You know, and
that's what City said on day one, sorry.
Yeah, City went there and immediately agreed to, I think, as I said in the paper, 108 million quid. And so what if Milan said, well, we could reckon we'd get about another quarter, 25% on top of that, 135 million. It becomes completely madness. But then Milan would like it to be done in the kind of way where Kaká agrees that he wouldn't mind going and there isn't some great conflict. They don't want to be seen pushing him out of the club in search of vulgar lucre.
Indeed, which is more or less the situation that he orchestrated with Shevchenko and did it very artfully. The Italian view, from the Gazetta, etc., is that Milan have been in this position. Very similar figures being mentioned by Chelsea in years gone by for Kaká, by Real Madrid in years gone by, and even by City last summer after the Abu Dhabi lot came in, that there was a massive offer for Kaká, and that they have turned it down, Kaká is a very special player for them. Whether that's going to remain their position in the long term, I'm not sure. From Kaká's point of view, I think that, as I was kind of hinting there, I think the fact that this is a player with what would Jesus do on his wristband, he's not necessarily the kind of guy who's going to go, you know what, there's a bundle of cash there, I'm going to take that over the bundle of cash I've already got and go to Man City. I think he does genuinely have a link with Milan. I think he has been unsettled and dissatisfied with the club, notably over the sale of Shevchenko, which he was really upset about and regarded as a bit of betrayal of the team's ambitions by the management. And secondly, because that happened more or less at the time that the club were docked 11 points in the match-fixing scandal. And I think if he was going to go, that would have been the time when he might have made the move. I think now that Milan are beginning to pick up again, they're making signings, making young signings at the back, that I don't see where he wants to jump ship.
Two questions on that. I mean, firstly, I thought he equivocated quite a lot last night. I mean, that might be because...
He's a very polite man.
Well, it could be just because he's so polite. Man, yeah. I was just about to say that. But he certainly wasn't firmly denying it at all. Or, you know, I mean, which may make things a bit difficult for him, perhaps, if that is his opinion. But also, I mean, we are in straitened times. I don't think Chelsea are going to be coming in at any time soon because there is no money to spend there. What about Berlusconi? I mean, he's involved in the property industry. He's a construction magnate. You know, okay, he's a billionaire and he's you know a politician, a very powerful politician in Italy. But how has he been affected by this credit crunch? You know, would he see that kind of money, 135 million euros that Kevin's mentioned, is actually going to fund the club for the next 3-4 years? Without him having to put any of his personal capital into it. And I think that's a consideration for that club, that actually this could be the time to cash in, because you know Man City's money is only going to be around until they've got the team that they want, and then they'll do what Chelsea have done, I think, and try and run the club along reasonable lines, because crikey, they're going to have a wage bill if they're paying 250 grand a week now.
The thing too, Matt, is I know there's been Pius interest in Kaká, but I don't think it was ever at this level. I don't recall Chelsea being linked to
absolutely not.
100. I'm talking about Milan investing £135 million for those three players. I mean, it never reached that kind of craziness before. And
well,
also,
the chance to get rid of Dida is quite a tempting one.
Contradicts the evidence here, because Kaká is saying I want to become captain and stay here forever. Meanwhile, we've got a kind of spokesman for him saying, well, you know, it's possible we could talk to Man City. I think the one thing we know is this will probably run till January the 31st.
Well, certainly his father, Bosco, has been given clearance by the club to talk with Man City, and I believe that might even be happening as we speak. Who knows?
He's going to become a priest, isn't he? I mean, he could set up his own Catholic, you know, a church to rival the Catholic Church in terms of his opulence and wealth.
He is a man of great faith, which I know puts everyone's hairs up on end in Britain.
Secular Britain, yeah.
Yeah, but in most of the rest
of the world... What does he do in Abu Dhabi if you're a massive Christian? I mean...
I don't know that that's necessarily an issue.
Relevant? No? Okay, sorry.
However,
about his wristband,
considering Jesus's previous helping the poor and the downtrodden and the lame and the halt and lepers and such like, surely Jesus would go to Man City and help them get them out of their current pickle.
Right, it's an interesting point, that, actually, Barry.
Yeah,
what would Jesus do if he was a top football player operating in today's market?
It's a humanitarian gesture by Kaká going to Man City and taking this money off their hands. Yeah.
I hope Kaká comes to play in England. I don't think he will. I think he'd be out of his mind to come and play for City. You know, but it would be great to see a player of his stature and reputation playing in the Championship next season.
But what would it do? Say that City had spent...
Think what it'd do for attendances.
Perhaps Gianluigi Buffon will be persuaded. I've played in the second division both in Italy and in England.
Well, I've never won the Coca-Cola Championship. That's what he said the last time, wasn't it?
Well, there you go. Dezinho saying, seems to me the City are making a rod for both their own backs and everyone else's with this stupid 100 million transfer business. If Kaká is worth 100 million, then I think West Ham are right to turn down 9 million from City for Craig Bellamy. Is Craig Bellamy less than a tenth as good as Kaká? Well, you've opened up a can of work.
I meant to say, the other thing is that Zidane was, what, 46 million in 2001?
Yeah.
8 years on, no one's come near that. If you had 8 years looking at compound interest and 46 million, though, you probably wouldn't be, I don't know, 5% a year. You'd be getting near, what, 70 or 80 or something like that.
Mm. You know? I think the point, though, is that Manchester City are absolutely unique. I mean, this is a sovereign wealth club. And when you're talking about, you know, they can afford it, that's true. But I can't see there being too many more sovereign wealth clubs in future. I think that had they not bought the club when they did, I don't think they'd be involved in football at all now. And now they're just trying to make a decent fist of it.
All right. Is there any possibility that they're actually going to end January just by buying a few kind of, shall we say, second tier signings, like, with all due respect, Craig Bellamy, etc.? And that these noises here are being made by the same Mansour fellow. Was it Mansour who started off by saying, we're going to be top four by the end of the season, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that?
It wasn't him, it was his predecessor.
Who got pushed out pretty quickly. Right,
that fellow there. And that they're just making up the noises. Kevin, you were saying in your article, and buying publicity for a couple of cheap flights to Milan.
No, I mean, I do think that they mean to buy him, but it also signaled what they can do and what their scope is. But they also mentioned in the article, it's a two-tier thing. You can't buy a team of superstars. It'd be crazy. You know what I mean? Real Madrid just about got away with it briefly in the early 2000s. But you see Man City haggling over kind of decent club players and not prepared to pay any price. So there's different categories, and Kaká, God knows, is a special case.
That's all part of the power struggle between Mark Hughes and the board, though. I mean, when we hear that they're going in for players like Scott Parker and Craig Bellamy, that's because Mark Hughes wants those players himself, and he's letting it be known that that's his strategy, that's his transfer strategy. Whereas there is yet another, you know, that is a club that's split down the middle at the top.
But to be fair, Matt, I mean, I think he did want Kaká, probably because he knows the owners want him to identify.
Well, absolutely.
I mean, why on earth wouldn't he want Kaká?
Of course he would, but we all know, they could go down with Kaká and Robinho, which is, I mean, he is a pragmatist enough to know that they need other players than them.
Barry, you pay no credence to the Sir Alex Ferguson mind game scenario. Do you buy into the Man City are about to take over the world thing, or do you think there's a lot of press talk in there?
Oh, of course there is a lot of press talk. I mean, they've got 100 million to spend, what would we buy Kaká? It shows a stunning lack of imagination, it has to be said.
What would you do with it then?
The things I do with £100 million are unbroadcastable, I'm afraid. But, you know, what if they did buy him and he arrived and, you know, broke his leg in the first game or something? Because I'm sure there'd be no shortage of defenders out to welcome him to the English Premier League.
Fortunately, Richard Dunn plays for Manchester City.
There's always training.
Oh, yes. Hmm.
But, you know, every time the transfer window opens, it's the same names cropping up, and, you know, they're being linked with different clubs every single day. This at the moment is Bellamy and Parker and Barton and blah, blah, blah. Most of it is complete nonsense. And our own website is as guilty of it as everyone else. But, you know, it's what the kids want, so that's what you have to give them.
My word. Well, that's probably it for part one then. Let's, in a second or two, we've still got lots of stuff to come. Sid Lowen, a big breaking scandal there in Madrid, some Italian news, previews of the weekend in the Premier League. But in a second or two, we'll have a quick look at the midweek action in Blighty in the FA Cup, and of course Man United's match with Wigan. Midweek action, ladies and gentlemen. There was plenty of it. In the Cup, it's that day of the season when Newcastle's ambitions are officially over for another year. Beaten by Hull. They're, what is it, 4 decades of silverlessness football? Silverwarelessness football continues. Joe Kinnear is in trouble because he got sent to the stands again after a bit of a... What did he... He had a bit of a set-to with Phil Brown on the sideline.
Well, he claims he didn't do anything wrong. He was just standing his ground, but his reputation precedes him. And right. That's why he got in trouble. And his reputation does precede him because his reputation is disgraceful. But he was shouting the odds at Phil Brown because Colaccini had kept going through the back of...
Cousin.
Daniel Cousin. And Joe Kinnear wasn't happy about it. Or Chris Hughton was giving out about it. And Phil Brown, Chris Hughton went head-to-head and then Joe stepped in to make things worse.
He stepped in to stand his ground. Yes. But there's some cleverly photoshopped pictures in the Sun of a snarling, ferocious Joe Kinnear just standing his ground.
Right. So then he was asked to leave the ground he was standing on and go and sit in the stands instead.
All those stairs.
So I think now he's got...
it took him until he's still climbing.
He's still going. I tell you what, Hull then are through to the fourth round for the first time in ages and ages and ages. Where they're going to be playing Millwall, which I'm excited about because that's, of course, Lions against Tigers, which means it'll be a big game between big game. Ooh. Right, okay. Also, Norwich lost to Charlton. Now, this is exciting because it's Charlton's first win in 18 matches and it meant the end for Norwich manager Glenn Roeder. All sorts of talk about who might be taking over from him at Norwich. Any?
I haven't heard any.
No, have you not? There's Paul Lynch has been mentioned in there.
But there is no greater ignominy, is there, than being beaten by Charlton, by Phil Parkinson's Charlton. I speak as somebody with an affection for Colchester United.
Mm. Palace beat Leicester. Burnley knocked out QPR. Swansea, Portsmouth, West Brom, Sheffield United, Wolves, Millwall all won away from home to progress. Yes. As did, Kevin, Chelsea, who walloped Southend 4-1. You were there. Yes. It almost went very wrong.
It did. I mean, they were a far better team, Chelsea, whenever they had the ball, as you'd expect, passed it beautifully. But they're on a team in a sort of state of anxiety and terror. I mean, they're pinging Alex in preference to Carvalho because he's big and husky, although he's only 100th of the player that Carvalho is. Alex's virtual first touch is to put the ball behind for a corner kick from 40 yards while trying to find Petacek somewhat aimlessly. And indirectly, that leads to an opening goal from Southend, which is, of course, scores from a corner. Chelsea has switched from man-marking to zonal marking, but it doesn't matter because the entire team's in a panic, and no matter what they do, they get it wrong at the moment in defence.
Is that now 8 of the last 11 goals scored against them have come from set pieces?
I beat it 9 from 12, so that sounds right. Yeah, we're on the same
9
track.
9 from 12. Yes, so. Now, Scolari, just again, broadly speaking, in the run-up to this game, lots of people had the feeling that there was another disaster lurking around the corner for the Brazilian manager, and he was being a bit blasé, saying, I'm not worried if I lose this job, there's always another job. increasing talk that the players are unhappy about his training regime or his selection in the case of Anelka and Drogba. Does this improve his position materially, or does it just...
Well, it takes away the threat of a sack for a bit longer, I suppose. I tend to think he'll last all the summer. It's very hard to replace people in mid-season. And if he keeps a Champions League position, then that's fine as far as these things go. But actually, Chelsea's attitude last night was very good. They tried to pass and attack constantly. You wonder why they didn't take a bit more positive attitude at Old Trafford at the weekend.
Mm.
Football is about small margins, and it didn't turn out this way, and that's clear. But it could quite easily have been 2-0 to a third division team against Chelsea yesterday at half time.
Fantastic save by Cech.
Great save from Cech, from yet another header. And at half time, you know, Ballack profits from what was a mix up between an easily avoidable mix up between defender and goalkeeper, which could have been 2-0 to Southend United. He would not be in a job if they'd have somehow clung on to a 2-0 lead after half time. Luis Felipe Scolari would surely not survive that this morning.
I say it's a very minor point, by the way. Salah Mukhlouf was really good last night. It's something I've never said about him. It's not bad for Chelsea. I just sometimes wonder, you know, what the purpose is. But I wonder, is this him doing better, or was it just because he was playing against
the opposition?
Yeah. I mean, and Joe Cole had a very good game last night as well. But
he's lost for a while.
Back when the news was announced during the Euros, I remember that lots of us were pretty sceptical about how Scolari was going to do with Chelsea. And then when the season started, we kind of had to revise our opinions because he seemed to be working wonders there, and his homely touch seemed to have unleashed all the creative instincts of this a hugely talented side. Now it's the other way around. I'm just wondering if the pendulum is going to swing back in his favour. Are all these posters, people like Nabolt and Marty Morrissey posting in about Scolari being found out and how he's an absolute joke and the only thing he ever won was the 2002 World Cup, which even Barry could have done with that that team against that opposition, because it was a weakened set of finalists, though, wasn't it?
To be fair, he won the Copa Libertadores twice. That's not bad.
Yeah. So, Dewey, are things... Is it all... is he dead and buried at Chelsea, or could this come back in his favour?
I think it's a big problem to the squad. I mean, it's so unbalanced. His two main forwards are Drogba and Anelka, and you wouldn't trust either of them. In Drogba's case, I'm not sure whether he's lacking interest or his knees bothering him or whatever, but, I mean, he was absolutely unforgivably bad at Old Trafford, almost dare one say intentionally bad. Oof. It was quite shocking.
But Anelka's the top scorer in the Premier League. He can't be that bad.
No, I know. I mean, but you wouldn't like to pin your. I mean, this is a guy who's been sold before and gone to Bolton and come back again. People tend not to have enormous faith in him.
Right. What about Stoke at Stamford Bridge on the weekend? Stamford Bridge, where Chelsea won only 4 out of 10 league games.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how their zonal marking goes against Stoke, who are obviously renowned for their set piece.
Absolutely. Rory Delap was going to have a field day.
Is Delap's throw, is it still a weapon?
Yeah, against Chelsea, of course it is. Yeah, I mean, these are big men again, aren't
they? He's having problems with the shoulder. He had to have painkilling injections and stuff. I haven't seen him throw a good one in a while.
You get him through that, don't you, game alone? Right. You could get 3 points at Stamford Bridge, of course. Mm.
They've only scored one goal in the last 5 league matches. Just thought I'd throw that out there. They have the worst away record in the top flight with just 3 points so far. But Chelsea at home, Southend got a draw there.
Exactly.
Yeah, Chelsea did play good football last night. I think they'll score 2 or 3 at the weekend if they play to a good standard.
Also, I just noticed here, the fact that they brought in Matthew Etherington and now James Beattie, is that going to revolutionise their offensive capabilities?
Where are you getting all these Stoke facts?
Well, that's quite widely known that they've picked up James Beattie.
Is that called research, is it?
Yeah. Ah. And Etherington played well for them last weekend from the highlights that I saw.
I
love the quote as well from Tony Pulis where he said, he was describing their transfer policy, he said, some people are like Crufts, but we're more like Battersea Dogs Home picking up strays, presumably because he likes players who are not used to having leads. That's my reading of that situation. What it means for poor old Etherington and Beattie, I'm not sure.
I think it's a cracking pair of signings. Really do. I think Etherington's a really, really decent club player. I'm surprised that he's gone to... his attitude's not that professional given his gambling proclivities, but then again, I think he'll do a great job for Stoke.
Excellent. Listen, while we're on the subject of the weekend's games, one more before we hear from Sid Lowe in Madrid. Manchester United, are they going to be on top on Saturday night? They're away to Bolton. Kevin McCarra.
look startled.
No, okay.
As if I know. No, but actually, Man U, yet again last night, single goal victory. They've had some of those, especially away from home, and now Rooney out, but
he scored and then he went off straight away.
But what they do have is a squad. I mean, that's the advantage. I mean, the Tevez and Berbatov, they aren't that stuck for forwards, are they? So Reebok's always difficult, but you expect a narrow United win.
And even if they're not on top, I'm sure Fergie will put his fingers to his temples and play some of those mind games he's so famous for and make us all think that they're on top.
Bolton haven't scored a goal in 5 hours and 57 minutes. United, meanwhile, haven't conceded one in 9 matches. That's amazing, isn't it?
So it'll be a scoring draw then.
It's an amazing stat. I mean, Vidic has been immense for United, and Johnny Evans has done a good job when he's come in.
Vidic, 7 million, Evra, 5.5 million. United's team building has been quite clever, as well as these big name signings that have appeared.
I mean, I painstakingly compiled a list of every Premier League club's most expensive signing this morning, which I was hoping to introduce in the CACA segment, but couldn't get a word in edgeways. But it's surprising how many of them have been disastrous. So pick a club.
Hull.
Stoke City.
Hull, Anthony Gardner, 2.5 million from Spurs, and he's been a flop.
Okay, Stoke.
Dave Kitson, 5.5 million, hasn't scored yet.
Okay.
Chelsea, Shevchenko, obviously, disaster. Blackburn, Andy Cole, disaster. Bolton, Johan Elmander, that hasn't gone so well. He's been pretty much of a disaster.
Sunderland?
Sunderland goalkeeper Craig Gordon, he's all right, but he wasn't worth 9 million. Spurs, Luka Modric, 16.6 million. He hasn't really impressed either.
Well, I don't know. That's one that could come.
He's
right.
Surrounded by the lame and the halt, I suppose.
I like Modric. He's a good player, Ben.
Yeah. Right. Who would you? Is there one example from that list that you would pull out in particular?
As a bad signing.
Yeah.
Jose Antonio Reyes never set the world on fire.
And how much did he cost Arsenal?
17 million.
Yeah, they didn't pay all of that, though. They paid about 8.
And you know,
Liverpool Torres is it?
Fernando Torres. He's been poor. Yeah, never delivered.
Right.
But,
okay,
did anyone else think, or was it just me, that Fergie's comments about Wigan last night were incredibly patronising, even by the standards of which people patronise Wigan, as we all do all the time, as their supporters never tire of reminding you. He said they were the best little club that his team had played all season in the Premiership, and. Just sounded really patronising.
Well, it did a bit.
Isn't it fair comment? I mean, they are rather good. I mean, Steve Bruce has done an incredible job there until they played. Until this past week, they'd won 6 of their previous 7 games.
It's now reached the point, I think, because we're always getting complaints from Wigan fans mailed in. You know that if you say anything nice about them at all, you're patronising them, and if you don't say anything nice about them, you're not giving them the credit they deserve. So it's a complete lose-lose
situation.
All 4
Wigan fans, let's get some emails off you.
It does tend to treat certain clubs and people like serfs. I mean, and Steve Bruce came into that category. It's nice to see him again. He came, he brought us 3 points, he went away. You know, that was the.
Listen, while we're on the subject then of plucky little Wigan. What about the chances? Because they're at Man City, aren't they? And we had some people posting in. Port Romeo says, can we please have a nice word for Titus Bramble? You know, we're all quick to criticise when things go wrong for him, but there he is playing at the back for Wigan and doing part of their success story. And Harry Kidnap, the great Barry Sanders, both commenting on the fact that Steve Bruce has done absolutely brilliantly on the transfer market. Mm. Palacios in particular, who many other managers, including, as Barry Sanders points out, Arsene Wenger, who decided that he wasn't up to scratch and he's done exceptionally. Matt?
He is. I mean, his alma mater is Manchester United, clearly, but I've got a sneaking suspicion, and I don't know why, but that he's going to end up being the next Arsenal manager after Arsene Wenger goes.
Steve Bruce.
Yeah, he is very well trusted by Wenger. He had players like Giroud and Traore and Fabrice Muamba went there. Bentner was there on loan.
Just after Matt dropped that gem on us, our system fused at the very thought of Steve Bruce taking over at the Emirates. And we're now recording on a small handheld device, which producer Pete happened to have handy. So you may have noticed a slight change in levels. But sadly, the pod will continue. We're all looking forward to an early lunch, but not to be, Barry.
Yeah, this is an hour has passed since Matt Scott said that thing.
And Steve Bruce is now twice. Arsenal manager.
Kaká's just signed beard. For Chelsea.
dear. Anyway, so well, let's what's the word I'm looking for? Let's crack on. That's the one. And talk to Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello.
Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello, James Richardson in near orbit.
Indeed. Capo Canon says, I think Sid actually lives at Madrid Airport, unable to leave due to some immigration technicality. His live appearance on the pod in London a few weeks ago was just a well-crafted bit of radio trickery. That's not true. It wasn't well-crafted.
exactly.
Sid, where are you today?
I'm at home.
Hey,
which is, of course,
in Madrid Airport.
Four at Barajas, yes.
Yeah. right, okay, now there's lots to talk about this week. In particular, the imminent departure of Raúl Calderón as Real Madrid president. Now, he's in all sorts of trouble, Sid. What are the charges against him, first of all?
Well, I don't actually know if it is an imminent departure. Oh. Essentially, let's kind of try and recap this because it's obviously a mess. Back in December, December the 7th, Raúl Calderón had a members' assembly at which he had to get the accounts of the club and some of his recent changes through the members' assembly, basically. Now, what happens if you lose a members' assembly? It's not necessarily the end of the world, but it tends to then lead to some sort of challenge on your leadership. He got through that members' assembly. It was a terrible event at which the ultra saw, of course, Real Madrid's radical fans were there shouting abuse at people.
So this is one of the charges, that he brought in the hardcore ultra saw to basically silence...
It's worse than that. That's the problem. At the time, one of the charges was that, hang on a minute, he's busting the ultra-sur. That was one of the allegations, which, of course, has not yet been proven. That he busting the ultra-sur who were chanting his name, shouting abuse at some of the members there that were against him, that were criticising his running of the club over the last year or so. And that went a little bit quiet. You know, he got through by the skin of his teeth. It was very, very unedifying, but Calderón got away with it. Then what happened was that on Monday, Marca broke the story which is a remarkable piece of investigative journalism from a newspaper where investigative journalism normally means we investigate whether Real Madrid are great or really great. But they basically broke the story that Calderon had, in their words, and this is the big allegedly coming in before the lawyers jump all over us, in their words, robbed the assembly. Now, their accusation was that Calderon had put some members in there to make sure they voted on his behalf and to essentially to get his measures over the last year through the assembly. Now, of course, that would be fairly damning if it were true. Calderon sent out a guy called Luis Barceno on Monday night, who is in charge of the the members of the club, basically in charge of looking after all the stuff, and was the man who had to arrange the assembly. He came out and said, we will investigate this, we will look into it, and if, of course, there is any wrongdoing, we will act on it. Now, of course, he didn't need to investigate it because Marca have set this story up really very well indeed, it has to be said. And the following day, they showed the photographs of, I think it was 9 people that they said had been sneaked in to the assembly. Now, it turns out the 9 people, all of them voted for Calderon. All of them were fairly aggressive in voting for Calderon during the day, and the votes are counted by hand with a show of hands. So in other words, you know, if you're aggressive in the assembly room, then it can be genuinely important. It's not a secret ballot. They said that. Calderon came out last night and said, yep, we admit it, it's true, but I had nothing to do with it. And what he did last night was he sacked Barthenas, who was the guy that was in charge, of the assembly. Sacked, more importantly, a guy called Nanin, who's a 25-year-old, basically a fixer for Calderon. And he sacked him because he said that Nanin had indeed sneaked people into the assembly by falsifying accreditations for them as members of the assembly, as assembly members with a voice and a vote, falsified their accreditation, get them in to get Calderon through. So he basically cut 2 heads last night, said it's nothing to do with him. He's very, very surprised. And these people who voted for him, they are people that, yes, I may have met them once or twice, but I just don't know them. Unfortunately for him, Mark has done another follow-up today. All of these people are very good friends with Nanin, very good friends with Calderon's son, friends of Calderon's brother, and most of them have been pretty close to Calderon himself. He is in big trouble.
Sid, you had, meantime, a Copa del Rey, what is it, quarterfinals midweek? Do we need to know about those, or should we pass straight on to the weekend action?
Well, very quickly, it's worth pointing out a couple of things. Barcelona got through against Atletico Madrid 2-1 win at home. They looked like they might be in trouble for a short while. Atletico scored the first goal, but then a fantastic piece of play from Iniesta gave Barcelona the second, scored by Ida Gudjonsson, who's playing a lot under Guardiola, by the way. And the other thing I suppose that's significant about that is that it sets up the next round will be Barcelona against Espanyol Catalan Derby. And given what we were talking about on Monday, also significant, Sevilla beat Deportivo 3-0. So Manolo Jimenez and his ghoulies continue in charge of Seville.
And his ghoulies.
Manolo Jimenez is the coach who is always greeted by the chant, Jimenez, Jimenez, que cojones tiene, which is basically, Jimenez, Jimenez, what balls you have.
Right.
He's known as being a coach whose talent is testicular.
Listen, the weekend, any one fixture that stands out for you, Sid?
Well, given everything that's happened with Ramon Calderon, Real Madrid Osasuna will be fascinating, not because the game itself will be fascinating, but because Ramon Calderon at the Bernabeu with the fans there, not so much on his back, but clamouring to stab him in it. I think it could be really, really interesting what happens at the Bernabeu on Sunday. As I say, Calderon's in big, big trouble. Other than that, in purely footballing terms, to be honest, there's not a huge amount this weekend that I find especially interesting on a personal level. Of course, there's one interesting fixture in so much as what it may mean, and that's Barcelona against Deportivo. It's the midway stage of the season. This will complete the first half of the season. Spain has mirror image halves of the season, so the first half of the season really means something. Barcelona could be about to set a record for the best ever points total in the first half of the season. They could reach the halfway stage with 50 points if they defeat Deportivo at the weekend. They've already got more than 50 goals.
Crikey. Sid, that's fantastic stuff. I look forward to hearing about that on Monday.
Hope so. Speak to them.
Thanks, Doctor.
Cheers.
That's Sid Lowe in Spain. Very shortly, we'll have a quick word about Italy, hear some more of your posts, and have a quick look forward to the weekend in the Premier League.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
Well, listeners, if you want to leave messages for us, go to the Football Weekly page, which can be found at guardian.co.uk/football, or there's always our Facebook option over on, well, Facebook. In Italy, I should mention that Roma beat Sampdoria midweek to move within 6 points of fourth place in the Champions League positions. On the weekend, Juve, who are now just 4 points behind Inter, are at Lazio. Should be an interesting game. Milan are hosting Fiorentina. The big question there, will David Beckham play? And will Pato continue his remarkable form from last weekend? Milan, by the way, seem to have sewn up some sort of option on Daniel Agger to pick him up at the end of this season by paying Liverpool a notional fee, given that Agger can soon activate a clause that gets him out for 7 million. I've lost everyone's attention with that sentence. Nobody's excited by Daniel Agger going to Milan. So let me try you on Atalanta taking on Inter, the league leaders. I say you should bet on Atalanta there. Yeah. I'll just throw that out there as a tip. Atalanta have an absolutely excellent record. They've only conceded 7 goals there all season. And although they haven't had a decent run of results recently, I just think that Atalanta, very well coached side. Gigi Del Neri, the man who was the architect of the Flying Donkeys, Chievo Miracle, etc., etc., etc. I reckon that Inter's luck seems to be running out. Posts, see if this interests you, eh? Templeton the Rat, does anyone wonder what sort of psychological meaning there might be in Sean Ingle going from Ron Jeremy to Jesus for one of his gags? I think we all know exactly.
Actually, funnily enough, I left the pod on Monday.
Yes.
Went down, checked my emails.
Yes.
And there was a friend of mine who was at a work convention in Las Vegas, and there was a porn convention going on in an adjacent hotel. And he had a photo of himself posing with Ron Jeremy. And so my mate and I sort of have a who can scourge or annoy or the most famous celebrity each year, and he's already won.
That's pretty.
No one's
going to
top
card.
Ron Jeremy.
Ron Jeremy, my word. Now, free kicks. We mentioned who's good at free kicks. Who's the all-time number one? Lots of mentions here. Mancien, personal favourites are Dwayne De Rosario, and he puts in a...
deliberately obscure.
Yeah,
surely.
Do you know who that is, Kevin? None of us know who that is. Hugo Thwack Almeida, I have heard of. But anyway, go and look on YouTube for them. Apparently they're great. Aussie with Footballs, among the many, saying that Attention Potter's the greatest free kick specialist ever is Sinisa Mihailovic, who I must admit is the first name that springs to my mind. I know that Rafael Honigstein was going with Juninho, who's another star.
Now, I'd agree with Mihailovic.
Mihailovic was absolutely stonking. Back in the kind of late 90s in Italy, they used to just wheel him on and he'd win a game. He scored 3 free kicks in 3 attempts in 1 game, I remember, against Sampdoria.
You see many better than Nakamura's against Manchester United.
Pure pressure, David Beckham's equaliser against Greece to get them into the World Cup.
That's great too, yeah.
Well, I tell you what, that's fascinating stuff. Many, many thanks for all your posts on that subject. Let's just finish off today's pod with a look forward to some more of the weekend's games. We mentioned one or two. We mentioned, obviously, Manchester United and Chelsea's game. We did touch on Wigan. Do you think they're going to get a result at Eastlands against Man City? Anyone? Does anyone have a view on that?
Yes.
Yeah?
I think they're going to win.
Excellent stuff, Barry. Excellent stuff. Spurs, meanwhile, are taking Portsmouth on at White Hart Lane. Last time the two sides met, Harry Redknapp obviously was in charge of Pompey, who won 2-0. The boot, though, on the other foot this time around, or not?
I noticed from today's newspaper, Matt, that you were more concerned about the travel arrangements for this game.
I really am. I think this could be a disaster, actually.
Because the Victoria line is closed.
Yeah, you've got 1,700 Pompey fans. I don't know if anybody knows Liverpool Street, but it's an open concourse with bars above it, which just seems to be a recipe for, you know, old school scenes from ID and the firm. And I am a little worried.
And there's
for
a little bit of ill feeling between these two sets.
Tremendous
of
ill feeling. I mean, when it was decided. On on consultation with the police 6 to 12 months ago, that they would shut it for engineering works, thinking that this wasn't a high risk game at all, and everybody knew that they would have to funnel both sets of fans through Liverpool Street to the train to White Hart Lane. But over what's happened with a dozen Spurs fans being arrested and charged for chanting at the last Pompey game,
At Sol Campbell,
and with Jermaine Defoe moving from Pompey to West Ham with Harry Redknapp,
Spurs,
who's again, you know, the devil in a dark blue suit.
Okay, also coming up, Blackburn are taking on Newcastle, Bolton, Man United, Chelsea, Stoke, etc., etc., etc. Oh, Hull, Arsenal should be interesting. Hull, of course, probably their performance of the season was that victory at the Emirates. Now, Hull have just got a long-awaited victory, albeit in the FA Cup, against Newcastle.
Well, they have been falling and falling, Hull. Yeah. I think the FA Cup result doesn't matter on FA Cup terms. It's a win of any sort. Must be a huge relief to them.
Well, they also had half a dozen non-first teamers in that team, so how much will they be carrying on that? You know, they can't carry that momentum. The players who were rested, the likes of Giovanni, will be brought back for this game. I still fancy Arsenal.
Do you know?
Well, Arsenal, people overlook the fact that they haven't been beaten themselves in seven or eight games, and they've taken Villa Park. They were unlucky to Villa equalise and beaten Chelsea.
They were lucky it wasn't 4-0 for Villa at half time.
But they were 2-0 up after 60 minutes.
I was there. But I mean, I thought Villa absolutely destroyed them in that game.
Sunderland, Aston Villa. West Brom taking on Borough. West Brom taking on Borough. West Ham taking on Fulham. Ooh. And on Monday,
Two teams in form. That's a decent game.
And West Ham managing to hang on against the sirens of the transfer market remarkably well, though, as we mentioned, Etherington has made his move. And then on Monday night, Barry, it is Liverpool against Everton, who haven't won at Anfield since 1999. Don't have any strikers. However, they have kept five clean sheets in a row, I know you'll be delighted to know. And they have that kind of look about them of a team that's somehow using the adversity to almost inspire them to become greater than the sum of their parts. There's no Fellaini involved, though, is it? He and his magnificent bonts will not be any part of this after he was sent off. Oh, no, he picked up his 10th yellow card last weekend. 10 yellow cards in 15. According to people in the know, sports psychologists and that, he should shave his huge afro because it's that's attracting the referee's attention. That's what they say.
Isn't David Moyes a fantastic manager? And it's he does spend some money, but not in the means others have. I think they've got something like 7 away wins this season, unless I'm misreading the table the other day, which is quite incredible. I mean, I think Man U don't have anything like as many as that.
Well, they seem to be a team with a purpose. Liverpool do seem to be a little bit confused at the moment, do they not? I'm wondering if there could be an upset on the cards come Monday night.
I didn't think the draw last week was that. It wasn't a good result. I didn't think a draw at Stoke was the end of the world for them. You know,
they drew at Anfield against Stoke in the 0-0
as well.
0-0
at Stoke.
Yeah, but they also had some good results as well. You know, they won at Stamford Bridge. Mm. Who doesn't? You're going to tell me.
Talking about Liverpool Everton, you may have seen in the Observer that Paul Hayward was supposed to be joining us today. The Observer's brand new signing, but he's gone off up to Merseyside to interview Jamie Carragher, which is apparently more important or something. However. Make sure you check that out on the site, and hopefully we'll be seeing Paul here in the pod soon. That, though, sadly, brings us to the end of today's marathon-esque Football Weekly Extra. So many, many thanks to producer Pete for the, you know, recording thereof. Matt Scott for joining us, Kevin McCarra, Barry Glendenning, me, James Richardson, and we'll be speaking to you again on Monday. Listeners, enjoy your weekend, and goodbye.